Hey friends, my name's Will.
And my name's Hannah.
And you're listening to the Spiritual Misfits podcast.
If you've ever found yourself on the fringes of Christian faith, this is a safe space for you.
Your questions, doubts, and hopes are all welcome here.
We're creating conversations, affirmations, meditations, and other resources to support you on your spiritual journey.
And let you know that even if you feel like a misfit, you don't have to feel alone. There are plenty of people whose behaviour in the name of Jesus is the very thing that would often lead me to want to reject the Christian faith I've grown up with. Dave Andrews, on the other hand, is the kind of person who makes me feel the opposite. He speaks about Jesus in a way that makes me feel like I'm encountering this story for the first time. I think this is largely because Dave has modelled a life around Sermon on the Mount ethics more than most people you meet in your average church. I think you'll see what I mean as you listen. During our conversation, we talk about Christian anarchy. Dave gives a pretty powerful critique of the early Christian creeds. And we also explore inclusivist theology that works alongside and with people from different religious traditions. I want to give you a heads up that this conversation gets really heavy in some places. Dave's commitment to a radical following of Christ-like ethics has meant he's been rejected, excommunicated, and banned from multiple Christian groups over the years. Dave shares openly about the way some of these occurrences impacted his health, including thoughts he had around taking his own life. If that is personally sensitive territory for you, I encourage you to be gentle with yourself as you listen, and please reach out to services like Beyond Blue or Lifeline if you need to. If you have experienced any form of rejection or loss of Christian community, I hope listening to this gives you a sense of solidarity. And I want to emphasize again that our whole ethos in making this podcast is to let you know that regardless of what you believe, you are worthy of belonging. You are not alone. Well, Dave Andrews, I want to very warmly welcome you to the Spiritual Misfits podcast. Great to have you with me today.
Yes, it's good to be with you too.
Got a lot of friends, Dave, that have very high regard for you. And I did briefly intersect with you around 10 years ago. I mean, you would have no memory of it whatsoever, but I was in a room where you were speaking to a group of school chaplains at the time. And I was one of those school chaplains. And I've actually referenced things you said in that session several times since then. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. And I know there are many other listeners to this show who are excited to hear what you have to say in this space as well. To begin with, would love to just get a little bit of your backstory with reference to this concept of spiritual misfittery. Have you ever felt like one? And what are some of the kind of turns and, you know, pathways that your life has taken up till now?
Yeah, well, the word misfit, I think, would be a good description of me and something that I've felt the whole of my life. My mother and father were in the Baptist ministry, so I was brought up in the church all my life. Since, as long as I can remember, I was consciously committed to the way of Jesus and found myself in constant tension with the church in which I was raised. I was really committed to following Christ's call to work with marginalized and disadvantaged people, even from a young age. Even at primary school and secondary school, I would reach out to kids who were on the margins and try to include them. I would seek to protect them when they were bullied, and I was often beaten and beaten very badly. In fact, I was hospitalized from some of my beatings. And my father often would try to include people in church who were often excluded, people who were sick or disturbed or drunk. And he would try to include them in church, but the elders and the deacons would often call the police to have those people evicted. And My father wept about that because he felt that this was, you know, a denial of the gospel, and I felt that contradiction as well. Being in a Baptist church, I was encouraged to join the Boys Brigade, and I found the Boys Brigade something that was appalling. I was brought up as a pacifist, and here I was opposed to a paramilitary group that emphasized obedience and drills and discipline. And I just found Boys Brigade abominable. So from a very early age, I was very clear that the way the church was structured, with its concern for status and for order, and groups that it ran like Boys Brigade, were not for me. I was quite alienated from that right from the start. And so all the way through my growing up in the church, I found myself in tension with the church in which I grew up, particularly the deacons and the choir, who I guess had the arrogance of youth thought of as the axis of evil in that congregation. So, yes, I understand about that from a very early age. And then since then, I've sought to explore what it means to follow the way of Jesus, regardless of how much conflict that would lead to with the groups and organizations that I was associated with. And so for the last 50 years, I've found myself in constant conflict with Christian institutions, church and parachurch organizations, and have found myself expelled and excommunicated on multiple occasions. And so I was painfully aware I was a misfit. I've never opted out of any of those, but I've been put out of many of them. So, yes, I can identify with being a misfit.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate you sharing honestly about that tension that has sort of existed throughout your life. And there are a couple questions that will touch on that, but very much in line with what you were just saying. When I was in this room about 10 years ago, listening to you speak, I really came away with the impression, I sort of had this thought run through my mind after that session, which was, it seems like Dave actually takes the words and ethics of Jesus seriously in a way that maybe I don't, or in a way that I don't necessarily see modeled by many people. It was so challenging. Now, many of my friends and many people of all ages, I think, in this moment in time are walking away from and rejecting forms of Christianity, often saying things like, it just doesn't seem very much like Jesus. So it seems like there is this misalignment often between what Christianity has become and what the way of Jesus is. Could you speak a little bit more about that? And do you think that they're kind of fundamentally incompatible in a way, the way of Jesus and institutional Christianity, or just tease out how you see the dynamic between those two things?
Yeah, sure. Before I answer that question, I'm just sitting here thinking about you being in a group of chaplains. My guess is that was associated with Scripture Union.
Yeah.
And Scripture Union is one of the groups from which I was banned for 10 years. So one among many, and I was only invited back later. So I imagine that the session I took with you was later after I'd been banned and was brought back. So that's a part of that story. In terms of the dissonance between the ethos of Jesus and the structures of the church that has been constructed in his name, I think it the dissonance is so great that I've often said that Christianity is the Antichrist. It is the opposite of what Christ was on about. If you want to look at the values of Jesus, particularly as they're unpacked in the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, I find that the churches that have been constructed using the rhetoric of Jesus contradict a lot of those values. So Jesus was subversive. He said, "Look, look at the way the Gentiles operate. They operate top down, develop coercive control, and he says explicitly, it shall not be so among you." And yet nearly every Christian group or an organization that uses the rhetoric of Jesus to sacralize their structure organizes their structure in a way that Jesus explicitly forbade. One of the things I love about Jesus is he started with hierarchy, because all organizations in our world are hierarchical. That's the starting point. He started as the master with his servants. He was like their guru. But after 3 years, he says, "I no longer call you servants. I call you friends." So his whole commitment was so thoroughly opposed to hierarchical structures that he reframed his relationships with his disciples over 3 years in such a way that he set aside that hierarchical language and framed his relationship with them in terms of mutuality rather than hierarchy, because he was on about that. So that's one of the significant differences between what I see as the way of Jesus and the way of the organizations that have co-opted his rhetoric to establish their empires that are really, to me, the antithesis of the kind of way of life that Jesus advocated, which is about, you know, laying down your life, reaching out to those that are lost, embracing those that are excluded. I mean, horrendous it is in Australia today that a lot of large Christian organizations believe that their best witness to Christianity is to exclude marginalized people. Mm. You know, I mean, how horrendous is that? That they see that as a badge of honor. I see this as disgraceful. But I'm not surprised, because right from the beginning, like about the fourth century, when the church was establishing itself as an institution in collaboration with the state, and they had their times to set their doctrines, the creeds were developed, which are, you know, foundation documents for those churches. And they were all about beliefs and not about behaviors. Mm. And not one of them mentions God being a God of love. Not one of them mentions the call to love God and love our neighbor as ourselves. Not one of them says the specific call of Jesus is to love our enemies. That is one of the most distinctive aspects of the way of Jesus that, you know, really describes it in a way that is really quite over and against the kind of churches that were constructed that supported states that went to war in the name of God. So it grieves me deeply that right from the beginning, you know, the Nicene Creed, which is often seen as a founding document, doesn't even mention love at all. Mm. And it's to me that they missed the whole point. No wonder we've ended up in this kind of dissonant reality in which the gospel seems to be something that is completely different from the messages that are preached in the name of Christ from these Christians groups and organizations.
It almost seems like that dissonance, which is a really good parallel term for the feeling of being a spiritual misfit, is encountering that dissonance. It almost feels like if you're raised in an organization where you are exposed to the words and teachings of Jesus, and yet the organization doesn't reflect that, it's just a natural thing that's going to happen if you're paying attention. Now, a lot of people perhaps manage to see their way around that or theologize their way around that even, but I think that what you're saying, it just strikes me that if you're paying attention, you're going to reach this moment where you see some perhaps unresolvable tensions in there. One of the phrases that you are sometimes described as is a Christian anarchist, Dave. And I imagine that to you, that's almost just putting words around what it means to take honestly some of what you're talking there about Jesus and his approach to doing away with some of that hierarchy. But could you talk a little bit more? Because I'm, as soon as I hear that phrase, Christian anarchist, I'm like very curious, as I imagine many people are. What does that actually mean, and are you comfortable being described in that way?
Well, I think I need to be very careful the way I describe this, because it's really interesting that in some translations of the Bible, even Peterson's translation in The Message, he describes the Antichrist as the anarchist. So for many Christians, being an anarchist is the Antichrist. So, I mean, it can be quite shocking for people that I would use that term to describe myself. Anarchist means one who is opposed to powers that oppress people and advocates self-management or self-control, not exercising control over others, not being allowing others to exercise control of you, but managing your own life in a way that you develop individual and collective self-control. And to me, self-control is one of the fruits of the Spirit, it says in Galatians 5:22. Then the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, kindness, faithfulness, and so on, and self-control. So I believe that self-control is one of the ways that the Spirit seeks to empower us rather than overpower us. And we need to develop cultures and structures that reflect that. Now, the terms Christian anarchy, I'd like to be very careful the way I talk about this, because I'm not committed to a Christian ideology or an anarchist ideology or a Christian anarchist ideology. In fact, I'm anti-ideology, because I think in one sense all isms should become wasms, because once an idea becomes an ideology, it becomes idolatry. So I say what I'm really committed to is what I call a Christ-like sensibility, which I call Christianarchy, because it is committed to the way of Christ over against those powers that would oppress us and manipulate us and exploit us, against the powers that be, even the religion that's been developed in the name of Christ that may exploit us. And given my understanding of the gospel, a Christ-like sensibility to me means a willingness to enter into solidarity with those that most of us consider least, to be committed to work with marginalized and disadvantaged people, to help them discover their potential as men and women made in the image of God, to empower them through being open to Spirit in processes and structures that give them the capacity to control themselves individually and collectively, and be committed then to use their energy for the welfare of all, to be really committed to love, to be committed to justice. And for me, love is the personal commitment to the welfare of others, and justice is the public manifestation of love. So for me, love and justice are interconnected like that. So if we can be going to be committed to Christianarchy, then for me, that means being committed to the way of Christ over against all those things that are contrary to the way of Christ, and a willingness to struggle for that from the bottom up and empower people in the process.
Wow, Dave, I'm going to listen back to that answer to that question probably about 10 times after we finished our chat, because that was just a brilliant framing of the kind of faith that I would aspire to live into, and how I would understand, you know, what it does mean to follow this radical first century Jesus that we see in the Gospels. If we are following that Jesus and living like he did, it does seem like we're going to butt up against all kinds of power structures and ideologies and isms, and that is going to lead to some real conflict. And you kind of alluded to that before, saying that there are various groups that have at times kind of kicked you out or disowned you or put, you know, barriers around your engagement with them. And I've actually got a question from my friend Rach, which really speaks to that, but I'll let Rach ask this one.
Hey, Dave, I'm Rachel. I did some courses of yours years ago in India at EFICOR with Tier Australia, and then in Brisbane with your community orientation course. These experiences were so thought-provoking and inspiring, and to be honest, a bit hard, but I think looking back, they were really helpful parts of my own spiritual misfit journey. I'd love to ask you a couple of questions. If I remember correctly, I believe you shared with us that in your lifetime, you'd gone out on a limb with a few somewhat controversial stances, and you had unfortunately experienced some fallout over this with various Christian communities. But that also, over time, many of those same communities sought to reconcile with you as they came around to see things differently. That's pretty amazing. On behalf of all the spiritual misfits listening, many of whom have also experienced some form of rejection from mainstream churches, I'd like to know, how did you cope with this rejection at the time? Especially if you were framed as a heretic or someone not to be associated with, as this type of reaction can often cause deep pain and an overwhelming feeling of being misunderstood. If reconciliation did then occur, and you're happy to share, how did that play out, and how did you feel? And lastly, what would you say to any spiritual misfits in a similar situation about how to respond to rejection or excommunication on any level by other Christians, and what to do mentally and spiritually to cope well in those circumstances? Thanks.
Wow. There's a lot in that, isn't there?
There is.
Maybe I can start responding, Will, and you can guide me whichever way you want to respond to particular parts of that that I may have missed or misunderstood. So I think we need to remember that when Jesus sent out his disciples, he gave us no illusions. He said, I send you out as sheep among wolves. Now, I don't know how often people hear that spoken about in churches, but it's part of the gospel. Jesus comes to us as the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep, but he doesn't give us any illusions. He says, you know, you're going to be vulnerable too. In the same way they attacked me, they're going to attack you. So I don't think there's any way we can avoid conflict if we seek to follow Jesus. Now, I don't believe we should look for conflict. I don't think we should generally seek to generate conflict, but I believe it's inevitable if we seek to live out the values of Jesus that we'll find ourselves in conflict with the systems in which we're located, religious and secular. So as I said, I was banned from Scripture Union. I was banned from Evangelical Union. I was also banned from the Baptist Theological College. I was banned from the Queensland Bible College, and heaps of other Christian groups and organisations.
What was, if you don't mind sharing, what were some of the reasons for that?
Okay, so with EU, it was because I was asked to give a talk about justice, and I used that Tony Campalo line, "You don't give a shit about the poor." And now you're more upset about the fact that I said shit, because you're more concerned about, you know, manners than you are about justice. And I was told pretty quickly that I'd never be invited back. Interestingly enough, I met a member of parliament years later who'd been at that meeting, and he said, "Oh, you're Dave Andrews. Yeah, I was at EU when you swore." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Can you remember why I swore?" He said, "No, I just remember that you swore," which proved the whole point. I don't generally swear. I just use that advisedly in that situation to make a comment. I was at the Brethren Church after the invasion of the Iraq. I just heard that other friends had been to church, and in the middle of the service, they'd shown videos of the Allies entering Baghdad and pulling down the statue of Saddam, and they'd stopped the service to give three cheers for the invading troops. And I thought, next time I get to speak at church, I'm going to really challenge Australia's complicity with America in this unjust and illegal war. And I was given a verse, you know, that talks about living under vine and fig tree and not learning war anymore. And I thought, oh, this is great. This is my opportunity. So I began to preach about a critique of American foreign policy, Australia's complicity, and the alternative approach that the prophets call us to. And I noticed that people were leaving, ones and twos, and then whole rows of people were walking out. And when I'd lost a third of the congregation, I thought, oh, God, this is not going real well. And I just said, look, if you want to leave, I understand that, but you need to know that if you stay, I'm not thinking you agree with me. You're just paying me the courtesy of listening to an alternative point of view, and that you will prove for yourself. That staunched the flow of people out of the building. And I finished my sermon. I went to the front of the church, and no one greeted me. One person did, and they were a visitor. And when a friend of mine who'd arranged me to speak there came up from taking kids' church, he said, "Look, Dave, I love you, but I'm never going to invite you back here again." So that was pretty clear and direct. At Scripture Union, the issue was that I have a belief that God is bigger than our religion, and that God can work with people who are not Christians, and God can speak truth to people through other religions. And so it's an inclusivist kind of theology that one evangelical minister who was associated with Scripture Union very closely found objectionable, and lobbied for me to be banned from Scripture Union for 10 years, I think it was. With YWAM, which probably was the defining influence experience in my life, it was that I opposed their hierarchy. I wasn't a part of YWAM. I joined Dilaram, which was a small community organization that was being taken over by YWAM. And I opposed that because I said, I don't agree with this notion of direction through revelation that those in authority get for all those that are subject to them. I believe that that's really manipulative and really exploitative, and I oppose that. And Lauren Cunningham, who was the director, flew in and prophesied against me, and I found myself put out on the street, literally, with my wife and child. I wasn't allowed to go back and even get any luggage, lest people encountered me. Everybody was threatened to be excommunicated if they gave me shelter. They thought I was trying to overthrow the leadership in YWAM in order to become a leader myself. And I said, that's not my interest at all. That just reflects the fact that you think only in hierarchical terms. I'm opposed to this hierarchical structure in itself. I said, to prove that, I will go anywhere for the next 6 months under a vow of silence and clean toilets to prove I have no ambition in that regard. Then at the end of that, bring me before all my peers. You can state your case, I'll state mine, and I will abide by whatever judgment they make. And they said, no, you're so deceptive, you'll deceive all those people. They call me a communist because I critique the finances in YWAM, where it was kind of pyramid level. Once you get to the top, you can make a lot of money. And by becoming a speaker at a school. So the rhetoric in YWAM is everybody pays to be a part of YWAM, which they do. Except once you get higher, you can go and speak in a school and they'll give you a love offering. And some people get hundreds, even thousands of dollars. So the higher up you go, the more money you can make. And they offered me those opportunities and I refused it and said, I disagree with this whole way of operating. It's a Ponzi scheme. And they called me a communist and they excommunicated me. So I found myself out in the street with my wife and child with nowhere to go and everybody I knew being threatened with excommunication. They even then went to other countries where people knew me and they spoke to church leaders to have nothing to do with me. So they systematically tried to destroy me and my life.
So I think out of Rach's question, there's this, how did you cope? How did you cope with that level of rejection? And then I think the second part around where reconciliation may have occurred, what did that look like? If you're happy to speak to either of those parts of the question.
Yeah, so this was devastating for me. It was a catastrophic experience. And I had a pain in my chest for months after this, and every time I met somebody associated with YWAM, I would start shaking. I felt suicidal, so much so that I thought I was shooting myself. And then I thought, no, that leave Ange and Yvonne. And I thought, oh no, I should shoot Ange and Yvonne and then myself. So that's how distressed I was. And so the challenge was how to deal with that. I was 25 years old, had been the leader of Dilaram in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal. And now I was being put out of Dilaram. Completely publicly denounced. So the first challenge for me was to reflect on their criticisms. It's easy just to react. And I believe that as a follower of Jesus, I need to reflect on their criticism and go, so where is the truth in what they're saying to me? And as I reflected on it, I thought even though the issues I raised were all true, that often my attitude had been really quite arrogant. And we're called to speak the truth in love. And I believe that I hadn't always spoken the truth in love, that some of it had come from a place of anger that hadn't been moderated by grace. And so I reflected on that. critically reflected on myself. I thought about the experience of failure, being denounced publicly like this and put out in the streets. And I thought, well, now I've got to find a faith that relates to abject failure. Because up until then, my faith had been based on the success of becoming a follower of Jesus when I was 3 or 4 years old, beginning to preach in churches when I was 15, going overseas when I was 20, being in charge of these community ministries by the time I was 25, you know, which was a kind of really successful ministry or missionary trajectory. And now I'd failed at my best. And I had to say, okay, I'm not alone in that kind of experience of crushing disappointment and despair. That is the reality for a lot of people in the world. And unless I can find a faith that relates to that kind of painful failure, I don't have a faith that's relevant to most people in the world. So I need to find that in order to relate to people. The third thing I did was think about how these good people did such bad things. And it's easy to demonize people. That's the easiest thing to do. But the reality is I realized that those structures were the same in YWAM as they were in most Christian groups and organizations. And unfortunately, where you have those hierarchical structures, everybody is accountable to the people at the top, but the people at the top aren't accountable to anybody but God, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, which is why there are so many problems with that system, right? And those structures. And so I said, okay, it's not enough to critique that structure. I need to be committed in every group or organization that I'm a part of from now on to set up structures of mutual accountability so that I offset my own power and the own power of my own personality and set up checks and balances within every group that I'm a part of. So from then on, in every group or organization I've been a part of, I've tried to set up structures of mutual accountability over and above hierarchical accountability, and to which I would be subject myself. Now, that took me years to work out. In the meantime, I was in great distress and moments of such despair that on occasion I felt like killing myself. And the way I coped with that was to keep coming back to the love of God I have encountered through my life in Jesus and experiencing Christ's love for me that can help me learn to love myself even when I internalized the hate of other people and I hated myself. And that saved me from committing suicide, to experience Christ's love. I related to passages of scripture where Jesus encountered the leper and the leper fell before Jesus and, felt completely unclean and totally untouchable, and Jesus reached out and touched him and healed him. And I felt like I was like that guy. You know, I felt unclean and I felt untouchable, but I tried to imagine Jesus reaching out to me and touching me like that leper, and just trying to experience existentially that kind of love for myself that helped me love myself again and helped me to love others as I loved myself again. And that gave the impetus then to reach out to those people who had excommunicated me and seek reconciliation. So in every case where I have been excommunicated, I have sought out to reach out to people to reconcile with them. Now, that hasn't been a particularly pain-free experience, because many of those people feel really sure that they've done the right thing in excluding me. In fact, what I've challenged are identity markers that are really important for them to hold on to. And so they've really often just been very resistant to any reconciliation. Now, in terms of YWAM, I reached out to Floyd McClung, who'd become the director of YWAM, who'd been a part of Dilaram with us, and I met him in three continents over a period of 5 years trying to reconcile. And finally, I met him, and he said that they'd decided to drop all the charges against me and as a heretic. And I just wept. I just thought, I think he thought I wept because I was so pleased to be, for that condemnation to be, set aside. Now, I wept because I thought, what a bloody waste of time this is. You had the word of the Lord to excommunicate me when I was a threat. Now I'm no longer a threat. You've got the word of the Lord to accept me. You haven't learned anything about how brutal this process is. So I wept. Now, the irony in that, of course, was they invited me to come back to YWAM. Now, I never wanted to be a part of YWAM, but they invited me back to YWAM. And I said, because we need people who would tell us the truth. To them, I've tried that before. That's not a particularly attractive option. But in the next 5 years, different YWAM groups did invite me to come and speak at their bases. And the challenge for me was to embrace that opportunity to do that without slide, sarcastic remarks, accepting I was going to a group that intentionally tried to destroy me. But I was getting beyond reaction to responding to them in a Christ-like way, where I looked for any opportunity I could to help. The Baptist Theological College had me banned. The guy who was the best man at my wedding and become the systematic theology lecturer at the Baptist College. And he'd led an inquiry into my theology that obviously they concluded was not acceptable for the Baptist Theological College. And so I was banned from there, even though I was brought up in the Baptist Church. And years later, a new principal phoned me and said, "Dave, would you come and teach at the college?" And I heard myself saying, "I'm happy to. Anything I can do to help, I will." And I put the phone down and I wept because I thought, I've done my inner work. So I didn't swear at him. I didn't try to negotiate some kind of recognition of the hurt that they'd caused me. I didn't require some kind of recompense. I just accepted that they had done that. It was very unlikely that they would ever recognize the damage that they'd done to me. But I wanted to deal with the issues in my own heart so I could respond as creatively and constructively as I could. And so I often went back and did some teaching for them.
Dave, first I just want to acknowledge all of that suffering and distress that you have shared. And I'm really grateful that you would do that. And just as Rach pointed out in the question, I know there are others listening who will have their own stories of that taste of rejection, or the feeling in the chest, or those thoughts in the darkest places. So both in what you've shared and what others may hear in that, I want to acknowledge that. And also acknowledge just that hard inner work that you have done, that I would not ever force on anybody.
No.
But what a difficult and beautiful path you have chosen to walk, Dave. So thank you for that. In many ways, it seems like a lot of what you have then done is tried to live an alternative answer to those systems and hierarchies. And over the long term, you have actually, in community, lived a very incarnational, neighbor-loving, justice-advocating, kind of life. I wonder if you could paint a little bit of a picture about what that has looked like or what it looks like today, because really that's where your life actually is an answer to the questions. You're not just tearing down and then saying that's it. You're actually trying to live an alternative. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the really difficult challenge is to construct the alternatives.
Mm.
I mean, I know lots of friends that are on a legitimate journey of deconstruction, and I think that's important. And we have sessions here in our community network here where we create a safe space for people to deconstruct their frameworks of faith that they've inherited from the churches that they've been indoctrinated in. And I think that's very important. But I've always, after some time, challenged those people to reconstruct, to find not only what they no longer believe, but what is left that they still believe, that they believe is worth living for. I think that that's really important. It's so painful to live through that process, especially if you're rejected by people that you love and who you desperately want to be loved by. It's very painful for you to move on to finding a way of finding the healing that you need to have the energy to put into reconstruction, because that takes a lot of energy to start all over again. And the challenge for me has been that I was in Dilaram and I got excommunicated. Then I was in Ashiana and we got exiled from India. And to think of starting all over again from scratch was very challenging. And I think we can only do it, you know, bit by bit, with no grand plans, to just accept where we are and work with what we've got, whatever it is, and little by little try to construct the alternatives. Now, for us in coming back to Australia, the challenge for Ange and I was to start all over again. And so we got together with a few friends and began to pray about what we're going to do, and decided that we wanted to develop a community network in our neighborhood that was inspired by Christ, but wasn't exclusively Christian, so it can include people that had reservations about Christ, but we were clear about affirming how Christ was the enchanting dynamic of our lives together, but they'd be welcome to journey with us along with their questions and reservations about that. So we started what we called the Waiters Union, and we made a commitment to try and find ways of being involved with our neighbours so that we could create a sense of community with people that were marginalised in a way that reflected the radical compassion of Jesus. Now, we didn't define ourselves as a Christian community because we didn't want to exclude people who felt very ambivalent or even antagonistic about Christ. We wanted to include those. We just said we were a community that was inspired by the example of Christ. We wanted to practice this, but everybody was welcome to be a part of it. And we were particularly wanting to develop networks of mutual friendships that was supportive of people in their struggle for dignity and integrity and grace. And so we started what we called the Waiters Union. We called ourselves the Waiters Union because we wanted to be like people that was just hanging out, available to help. And we never incorporated ourselves. So we didn't set up our own hierarchy for the purposes of incorporation. We remained unincorporated as the Waiters Union, as a non-formal network. And we started to get involved with people in our neighbourhood who were struggling, and we'd find ways of supporting them and then helping them developed little groups and organizations and programs that actually dealt with the issues they were working with, and named none of them after the Waiters Union. We encouraged them to name them, operate them, and organize them for themselves, and we would be a catalyst for that. We wanted to be like leaven in the dough. Once you get mixed in, you can't tell the difference, but you make a difference by inspiring, you know, some kind of transformation. And so we've tried to be a part of developing a whole lot of groups and organizations and programs in our neighborhood, none of which bear our name, but which in which we're trying to facilitate a transformative process in which people can be empowered and realize some of their potential.
Wow. Dave, there's so much in that it really hits my own thinking in terms of we're trying to lead an alternative, I guess, faith community that very much is inclusive of people at all different places with faith, doubt, questions. There's no test around any of that stuff. And then to do that in an organic, networked, kind of grassrootsy way that is for the common good, I love that, and I'm really inspired by your example over the long term and in many different ways. I think one thing I would be keen to touch on before we kind of wrap up this conversation is that inclusive interfaith thing, because, you know, it's become for me, and I think you really spoke beautifully to it just then, I want to have, I want to own the beautiful Christianity that I have while being someone who makes so much space and is so hospitable towards other ways of seeing and being. Yeah. And for me, I grew up with a faith that was an absolute expert on every religion in the world and knew in three quick points how to tear down Islam or Buddhism or secular humanism or anything. And I don't want that anymore. But it can almost feel like, well, you either have that or you're just a pluralistic, everything goes. This is how the devil's advocate kind of argument goes. But could you speak a little bit more about what it means to have an interfaith engagement that is genuinely curious about and seeking the best in other worldviews while kind of owning and grounding yourself within the one you have?
Okay, so for me, like you, I was brought up in a tradition where Christians were right, everybody else was wrong. There was no place for dialogue. There was only a place for preaching. I went to India, engaged lots of Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims in arguments where I tried to prove that I was right and they were wrong. After some time, I realized I'd won a lot of arguments, but not won many friends, and that I hadn't really demonstrated in the way that I related to people good news. It was basically bad news. And so I began to critically reflect on the way I had been brought up and brought up to relate to other people. So I went through a process of deconstruction and reconstruction. In that, I tried to come back to Jesus and to a commitment to follow the way of Jesus and look for that which was like the way of Jesus in other traditions and religions, and rather than find faults with them, affirm whatever I found in them that reflected some of the way of Jesus, whether they acknowledge that name or not. And so I have deliberately entered into relationships, particularly in recent years since 9/11, with Muslims to affirm within their tradition what is Christ-like rather than what is Christian, what is Christ-like. And one of the things that my Muslim friends say defines the essence of their religion is the Bismillah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most merciful and gracious. And they take that as a kind of like a mantra. And I say, oh, the mercy and grace of God is something that Jesus really affirmed, and within my tradition, I can really fully affirm that within your tradition, and I want to affirm that. And with you, go on a journey of what does that mean for critically reflecting in our own traditions where we're not merciful or gracious? And what does that mean for how we can help each other become merciful and gracious? Now, I mean, the amazing thing is, well, recently I was contracted to write training manuals for Muslim leaders in northern Sri Lanka who are being persecuted by extremist Buddhists and who realize that if they react like the Buddhists in Myanmar, they're going to be crushed like the Rohingya. So they want to find a way of affirming their faith as Muslims without and be assertive about that without being aggressive. They want to find a way of living out Bismillah spirituality that's full of mercy and grace so that they can short circuit the cycles of violence. And so in the last 12 months, I've written 6 training manuals for Muslim leaders in northern Sri Lanka, helping them explore that Bismillah spirituality within their own traditions, under the guidance of Muslim scholars who I'm collaborating with. It's just been fantastic as a Christian to be invited into that space with Muslims to explore with them what our respective faiths mean and how we can live that out. And I just think that is just glorious. But that would have been inconceivable for me when I was a young man, that I would have been able to embrace that as a possibility, as a redemptive possibility.
I think that's brilliant, Dave. Thanks so much for sharing that story. Well, I really want to honour your time, although I could speak to you for so long and just, soak in your wisdom and experience and stories. But maybe just to give you a last sentence or two, you know, most people listening to this, they grew up evangelical. They no longer identify as evangelical. Now, for some people, that's the end of the road, and maybe they just want to go and be understandably angry about it. But again, the majority of people listening to this do want some alternative. They do want to find a spirituality that they can live into and embody. But maybe they find themselves at some point in that journey feeling a bit lost or a bit, you know, in the question marks. What would be the just sentence or two that you'd want to leave in people's hearts who are in that sort of space?
I would say that for me, what was most important was to hold on to my faith in Jesus. I tell people the longer I live, the less I believe, but the little I believe in more and more. And I would say to people, you know, if you can, let go of all that extraneous stuff that maybe before you thought was really important but has not been helpful to you. And focus on Jesus in the Gospels and try to rediscover who Jesus means to you and explore what the way of Jesus might mean for you. And gather around some people who will just help you do that. And if necessary, let everything else go and just go with that the best you can.
Spiritual Misfits podcast is brought to you by Meeting Ground, a church for the misfits. We know we are only one small and humble faith community, but we're making this work in the hope that we can encourage and empower other people in similar spaces. If you haven't already done so, jump on our website, spiritualmisfits.com.au, and join our mailing list to receive the Sunday message. No spam, no sales, just weekly encouragement around faith from the fringes. If you know someone who would benefit from hearing this episode, please share it and consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast platform or social media of choice. We'll catch you next time. Until then, take care and be kind.